George Clooney. I don't have to tell you why I like George. He is open and very funny to talk with, but also thoughtful and committed to the values in which he believes. His movies show both sides. The first time I interviewed George was in 1995. After years of struggling for success in a series of television flops, he had landed his big break in the medical series ER. Unlike many stars of television, George successfully made the transition to films. His first big hit was From Dusk Till Dawn, and our conversation took place just before its release. Two things I remember most from that interview. One, he had a pet pig, not a piglet, a big fat pig named Max. Max was inside, not outside the house, when George introduced us. Max has since died. The other thing is his answer when, knowing he was divorced and a bachelor, I asked if he wanted to remarry. Most of the time when I ask this rather prosaic question, the answer is, yes, when I find the right person. This is usually followed by a poignant expression of a desire to have children. Not George, who said he would never marry again. When I asked why, he said simply that he was not good at it. Nor did he want children. The last time I interviewed George was in 2006. I asked then if the women he took out ever expected or hoped he would marry them, and if so, what did he tell them? "You know what's funny," he said. "It is because of you that I don't have to. It's already out there, so you've done all the work for me, and I thank you for that." You're welcome, George. Tom Cruise is someone I have interviewed many times and probably will interview again. Yet while Tom wants to be open and candid, he has learned over the years to deflect with a laugh any question that makes him uncomfortable. He doesn't dodge tough questions about Scientology or his love for his wife Katie, but anything that may make him explore himself is handled with a big grin and that forced laugh. But let me say this about Tom. Raised by a single mother and three sisters, he could not be more considerate toward women. His Scientology beliefs, however controversial, have inspired him to live his life trying, as he has often said, to do good. "I try to help people any chance I get, wherever I have the opportunity to give back to the life that I have." He is, in short, one of the nicest people I know. Even though I usually walk away from one of our interviews wondering what, if anything, I got. Angelina Jolie. It's not just that I applaud her work with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and her personal commitment to raising what are now four young children. I really like her. I first interviewed Angelina in July 2003. She was plugging Lara Croft Tomb Raider, The Cradle of Life, a sequel to her highly successful adventure film, Lara Croft Tomb Raider. Hardly a milestone in one's career, unlike Girl Interrupted, for which she'd won an Academy Award 3 years before. Her bizarre 3-year marriage to actor Billy Bob Thornton, during which she'd worn a vial with drops of his blood around her neck and added his name to the many tattoos on her body, was officially over. She had adopted a little boy from Cambodia, whom she named Maddox. I thought Angelina was gorgeous. I also thought she was unusually open. In one of the more startling interviews I've ever done, she told me of her recurring thoughts of death as she was growing up. At 15, she took home courses in embalming and of cutting herself with knives because it made her feel better. "I was self-destructive always," she said. "I didn't feel close enough to another person. I didn't feel alive enough. Early on in my first sexual relationship, I brought knives out and had a night where we attacked each other. It was so stupid because I still have a mark next to my jugular vein. But it was a release of some kind. It felt so primitive, and it felt so honest. And then I had to deal with not telling my mother and hiding the gauze bandage that I wore to high school." But all that faded, she said, when she adopted Maddox. "It's an amazing thing to take care of a child and have a child trust you and love you. It makes me feel like I somehow have a purpose. If he's okay, if he's healthy, nothing else matters to me," she said, "and that's just such a clarity I never knew." At the time, her relationship with Maddox was the only relationship she wanted. I asked if she could imagine herself getting married again, and she answered no. I think that having a child, as I do now, would mean that this person would become a father to my son, and that means it would have to be permanent. I haven't had a good experience with my own father or with the men in my life, so I don't want to have a temporary relationship for my son. As for adopting more children, she said she hoped to adopt many, but she didn't want to give birth to her own child. I think it's so wonderful when a couple loves each other and they have a child. But now, as an adoptive parent, I have this weird feeling that there would be that kid that I would have adopted if I hadn't had my own. That was in 2003. All this changed, of course, when she met Brad Pitt. Still no marriage, but 4 children, 3 adopted, and 1 their biological daughter. At this writing, Angelina seems to have the purpose she so long ago yearned for. Then there's a man who, some say, would make a great president. However, there is one small impediment. He wasn't born in this country. I'm talking about Arnold Schwarzenegger, the current governor of California. Schwarzenegger has a remarkable story to tell. When he came to this country from Austria as a champion bodybuilder, no one took him seriously. He had a funny name, he refused to change, a muscle-bound body some thought strange, and a strong accent. But he also had contagious warmth, a brilliant mind, and a vision. He, of course, became one of the strongest box office figures in the business. He also married one terrific lady, a member of Kennedy royalty, Maria Shriver. I could interview Schwarzenegger again and again. He always has something interesting to say. This is from an interview done for my Academy Award Night special of 1990. "What makes one guy a champion and the other one not?" I asked. Schwarzenegger. "It's drive. It's the will. There are certain people that grow up with a tremendous hunger, and it's usually kids that have struggled when they were young. When you grow up comfortable and in peace and happiness, all those things will produce a very balanced person and a good person, but it will not create the will and determination and hunger that you need to be the best in the world." In case you are wondering if Schwarzenegger was talking about himself, here was his answer to my next question. "Do you have a philosophy by which you live?" Schwarzenegger. "Staying hungry, that's it." Clint Eastwood, another Hollywood legend whose talent and creativity have not diminished with age. If anyone has seen my specials, especially when we rerun certain of my interviews, they will be familiar with the following story. In 1982, I interviewed Clint for the second time. This one was done in a sunny field with wildflowers in Carmel, California, about 40 minutes by plane from Hollywood. He was then 52 and unmarried. As I reported in the introduction to my piece, "Eastwood stands tall, shoots straight, and pulls in higher grosses than anyone else. He keeps a low profile, keeps his private life private, and seldom gives interviews. Everything about him is sparse, including the dialogue." Here's a portion of how it went. Me. "You hear people say that you are aloof, mysterious, and similar to the characters you play on camera. Are you afraid of showing emotions?" Eastwood. "I don't think so. I think the image of the character I play comes out reserved because that is probably something that is very easy for me. I don't feel compelled to tell every thought that is in my mind. I know a lot of people get a catharsis, they get release from that, and that's why psychiatrists make so much money. But to me, I don't particularly want to unload on anybody."
Me. "Never went to a psychiatrist." Eastwood.
"I never felt the urge. I always felt I could go out and walk through this field and look at these flowers and trees and just unload myself."
Me. "Do you ever tell a woman you are close to?"
Eastwood. "Oh, we talk about certain things, but there's never 100%. Let me put it this way. If you break it down from 100%, you might talk 60%. Would you want to know 100% of what there is to know?
Me.
"I think it's nice to know. You would drive me nuts and I would drive you crazy because I would be asking more and more."
Eastwood then looked deep into my eyes and with a mischievous smile said,
Well, we could try and see if it worked out. At which point, for the first and last time in an interview, I lost it. I got all flustered and goofy and told the cameraman to stop tape. What's worse, after the interview, Eastwood asked if I wanted to stay and have dinner with him. God knows why, but I said I had to fly back to Los Angeles with my crew. So actually, it isn't that I want to do the interview over, it's that I want to do the dinner. Who knows what might have happened? Oh, well, as I said, he is married to a lovely woman named Dina, and they seem very happy. Wonder if she gets through 100%. Did I tell you that I could interview Oprah Winfrey over and over? In my opinion, every accolade she receives, she deserves. The woman has overcome so much and accomplished so much and changed so many lives for the better. My relationship with Oprah goes back many years. Perhaps the most revealing interview I did with her was in April 1988. At that time, her program had been on national television for only a year and a half, but was already the highest-rated syndicated talk show in the country. No wonder. Talk about revealing yourself. She kept very little of her own life back, and in so doing, millions of people could relate to her and know that she had suffered as many of them had. In this regard, the toughest part of our conversation was when Oprah talked about being raped when she was 9 years old and not even realizing it. I remember being at a relative's house, and I had been left with a 19-year-old cousin, and he raped me. And I knew it was bad, and I knew it was wrong, mainly because it hurt so bad. He took me to get ice cream and to the zoo afterward, and told me that if I ever told, we would both get into trouble, so I never did. I went into the fifth grade that fall, and I remember Maria Gonzalez on the playground telling me how babies came into the world. So I went through the entire fifth grade every day thinking, I'm going to have a baby. It happened again, Oprah said, with a boyfriend of another relative who lived in her mother's house. What happens to you after a while, you start to think you are marked. What it did for me was it made me a sexually promiscuous teenager. If no one has shown you any kind of affection or attention, you confuse that with love, and so you go searching for it in other places. Oprah said she used to bring boys home when her mother wasn't there, until at 14, she was sent to live with her father. He was very strict with her, she said, because he knew what he had to deal with. Listening to this, I said, Oprah, I hear you and wonder, where did this lady come from? How did you get to be this? Oprah answered, beginning with this sentence. Somewhere, she said, I have always known that I was born for greatness. She went on, I have always felt it. I don't regret being born illegitimately. I don't regret all of that past confusion. I don't regret it at all. It has made me exactly who I am. I probably would not, without my past sexual abuse included, be able to handle what is happening to me now. Years later, in another interview, Oprah said that she had been criticized by some and called arrogant for saying that she knew all along she had been born for greatness. She explained that she didn't mean that she herself was great, but that, as she put it, every soul has its calling. So I believe that I was born at the right time, born to do great things. That's what I meant by being born to greatness. Let me tell you why else I remember this 1988 interview with Oprah. Oprah told me of entering a contest, misfire prevention of all things. She was just 16 and the only black contestant. She never expected to win, but she did. And I said I wanted to be a journalist like Barbara Walters. And you know why I said that? I had not a clue what I really wanted to do with my life, but I had seen you on the Today Show that morning, and for me, you were a mentor. You were the only woman I knew who was doing anything, and so I thought, yeah, that's a good thing. That's what I'll do. That's what I'll say. I really had no intention of going into the business, but it sounded like a good answer, and I ended up doing it. It was a self-fulfilling prophecy for me. Oprah told me she copied how I sat, with her hand under her chin, as I often did,
and when she finally auditioned, she looked down at her questions as I did, even though she had no real questions. Then she would look up and talk. "I had Barbara Walters in my head," she said, "and for the longest time I'd watch you every morning, and I'd go on the air and I would imitate you." "I take full responsibility for you," I told this great accomplished woman. "As well you should," said Oprah. So who cares if some of my interviews are a bust? I can claim, rightly or wrongly, that I mentored Oprah Winfrey. Celebrities who affected my life. If an interview is informative, touching, intellectually or emotionally affecting, I learn something. Even doing the homework teaches me something. But after having conducted hundreds of interviews, few stick to my bones, as it were. There are some, however, which, because of my own inner needs, have stayed with me, affected my life, and perhaps even changed me. When I talked to Betty Davis in 1987, she was 78 and physically diminished by a severe stroke that had left her face twisted and her speech badly impaired. Yet she had the same feisty spirit that had marked all of her more than 90 films and won her 2 Academy Awards. But what stuck with me from that interview were her views on marriage. I was always interested in what made a marriage work, since I seemed not to be very good at it. Here now, Betty Davis's prescription for a good marriage.
"Separate bathrooms," she laughed. "That gives you a chance."
Davis had her share of chances, having been married 4 times. She must have thought of her bathroom solution too late. She had walked that tightrope between being an independent, successful woman and one who also wanted a man to dote on her. Her favorite song, she told me, was "Someone to Watch Over Me." Davis had never found that someone.
"Nobody ever thought I needed it," she said. "I was always competent, earned my own way. And nobody would have thought I needed someone to watch over me."
That certainly resonated with me. The other topic I have continuously chewed over is the difficulty women have balancing a career with a family. As I have pointed out, while I had been torn for years making choices between Jackie and my work, Barbara Bush would have told me, "No choice, children first." Jackie and I never stopped loving each other, even during the toughest of times. Betty Davis, on the other hand, had a daughter she professed to have adored, but who published a vicious and hurtful memoir about her mother. Davis was distraught about this, and after the memoir was published, never spoke to her daughter again. She didn't feel she had done anything to deserve the humiliation, she said, and blamed the estrangement on her ambition and lifelong dedication to get to the top. At the end of the interview, I asked Betty Davis to describe herself, which she did in her halting speech, in just 5 words.
"I am just too much."
Maybe her daughter felt that way too. If Betty Davis was just too much, so in spades was Katharine Hepburn. I've never had a mentor, but if I could have, I would have chosen Hepburn. She was such an independent woman, opinionated and positive about things, that when she said something, it was as if it were written in stone and you had to pay attention to it. In one of my interviews with her, I did 4, she said, "I know what's right and wrong, and I see things in black and white, don't you?" I had recently returned from the Middle East and said, "There are times, Miss Hepburn, when I see things not in black and white, but in shades of gray." Katharine Hepburn drew herself up and said, "Well, I pity you." So much for the diplomatic middle road. She loved to terrify people, and if ever the expression, "her bark was worse than her bite," applied to anyone, it applied to Hepburn. For years, she had refused my requests for an interview. When she finally agreed, she said she wanted to meet me first. Early evening, 5 p.m., at her brownstone in the East 40s in New York. Something like 5 minutes after 5, I showed up all smiles and eager to please. When the door was opened, there was Hepburn at the top of her stairs, looking just as Hepburn should look, pants, turtleneck sweater, another sweater tied around her neck, hair piled up.
"You are late," she barked. "Have you brought me chocolates?"
I hadn't, but from then on, I never showed up without them. She always sent me a thank you note in her almost illegible, spidery handwriting. She had inherited what she called the shakes from her grandfather, and she had tremors in her hands. We got on quite well that day, and I visited her many times after that, often accompanied by the gregarious and good-natured gossip columnist Liz Smith and by Cynthia McFadden, Hepburn's young friend who was living with her at that time. We spent many evenings sitting in Hepburn's small but cozy living room on the second floor of her townhouse. A fire was usually lit, and we were served dinner on a tray, big, ample portions of meat and potatoes, ice cream for dessert. Hepburn, then 71, would give us her opinions. Careers and marriage did not mix. Children and careers were out of the question. Suffice it to say, Hepburn's opinions on the balancing act of marriage, career, and children stayed with me. She was so certain in private and in our interviews, I can repeat them almost verbatim to this day. "It's impossible," she told me. "If I were a man, I would not marry a woman with a career, and I'd torture myself as a mother. Supposing little Johnny or little Katie had the mumps and I had an opening night, I really would want to strangle the children. I'd be thinking to myself, 'God, I've got to get in the mood, and what's the matter with them? Get out of my way.'" She made a gesture of pushing the kids away, and in her distinctive, wobbly voice, also a result of the shakes, went on to give her solution to the confusing gender roles that had befallen men and the growing number of working women. "I put on pants 50 years ago and declared a sort of middle road. I have not lived as a woman, I have lived as a man."
"How?" I asked her.
"Well, I've just done what I damn well wanted to," she replied. "I've made enough money to support myself, and I ain't afraid of being alone."
For a woman who wasn't afraid of being alone, she had an awful lot of men in her life. She had even been married once, very briefly, when she was young, and had affairs with her agent Leland Hayward and the billionaire eccentric Howard Hughes before settling down to a 27-year love affair with Spencer Tracy. They never married. They couldn't. Tracy, her co-star in 9 films, was already married, a Catholic, and the father of 2 children, one of whom was deaf. But, she said, "We were as good as married."
Tracy died of heart failure in 1967, just 2 weeks after completing his last film with Hepburn, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. She found him, lying on her kitchen floor, and immediately called his wife, Louise. It was the first time the two women had talked, and when Mrs. Tracy and her children arrived to make the funeral arrangements, the first time they met. Hepburn didn't attend the funeral out of respect for Tracy's family. "I was not his wife," she told me in a quiet voice. Instead, she said, she drove by the funeral to watch the crowds gathering to honor him. She never watched Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. "The memories," she said, "were too painful." For all her tough talk about the impossibility of marriage, family, and career, there were photographs of Spencer Tracy all over her house, along with a portrait of him and some paintings he had done himself. Theirs was a true love story, with or without children and the legal trappings of marriage. When she died in 2003 at the age of 96, the lights of Broadway were dimmed in tribute. In my case, I treasure every memory of our interviews and the small private dinners we shared. "Thank you for the champagne and the chocolates," she wrote me after one such dinner. "I certainly needed my fix." Hepburn left me an odd inheritance. In one of our interviews, I did the last when she was 84, I asked why she thought she had become so much of a legend, and she said that she had become a sort of thing. "What sort of thing?" I asked, to which she replied, "I'm like a tree." She said this very quickly, but I picked up on it and asked, "What kind of tree are you?" She replied, "I hope I'm not an elm with Dutch elm diseases or a weeping willow dropping all its leaves. Instead, she chose to be an oak tree.
I saw one recently in the woods, a white oak, strong and great like that.
And she stretched out her arms in imitation. A terrific moment, except to this day I am ridiculed for asking her what kind of tree she wanted to be. Doesn't matter that she introduced the whole thing. I am stuck with it.
Johnny Carson was just one of the people who wouldn't let the tree issue go, so when he heckled me about it during an interview some years later, I finally broke down and asked him what kind of tree he'd like to be.
A tumbleweed, he replied. Audrey Hepburn also affected my life, even though she was totally different from the great Kate. Unlike the older, no-nonsense Hepburn, Audrey was fragile and vulnerable. She was so enchanting and beautiful playing a princess in her first American film, Roman Holiday, in 1953, for which she won the Academy Award. Thin as a rail, she dressed in Givenchy, not pants, and became every young woman's idol, including mine. I cut my hair like hers, short with bangs, wore little sleeveless black dresses copied from Givenchy originals, and used gobs of eyeliner to try to make my eyes as wide and dramatic as hers. Few people tried to imitate Katharine Hepburn's angular, high cheekbone look, but for a while, we were a nation of Audrey Hepburn wannabes. I dare say in the 1950s and 1960s, every man and every woman was a little bit in love with Audrey Hepburn. She was about to turn 60 when I interviewed her in Mexico in 1989. By then, she'd been married twice, first to actor Mel Ferrer, then to an Italian psychiatrist, Andrea Doty, and for the last 9 years, she'd been living happily with Robert Walders, a Dutch actor and the widower of a much older actress, Merle Oberon. Hepburn had 2 grown sons, 1 from each marriage, and was still lovely, still enchanting. She was also unflappable. During the interview, a bird flying overhead relieved itself, splattering on her perfectly pristine white dress, and she couldn't have cared less. Audrey Hepburn had her own answer to the dilemma of combining work, a husband, and children. Her solution?
I quit movies to stay with my children, she said. I couldn't take the stress of being away from my sons. I missed them too much. I became emotionally unhappy.
It was a difficult decision for the actress, who made 20 movies and earned 4 more Academy Award nominations after that Oscar for Roman Holiday.
I was miserable both ways, she said. I have the greatest admiration for women who have a career, who can take care of the husband and take care of their children, but I couldn't.
Hepburn felt she could do 3 jobs at once, make a movie, shop, and cook, and that was it.
I cannot deal with too many emotions, she said.
I asked her if, looking back, she regretted giving up her career.
Oh, Lord, no, she said. Had I done it the other way around, I'd be miserable today. If I just had movies to look back on and not have known my boys?
For years, Audrey had been a special ambassador for UNICEF. She was tireless in her efforts to make life better for impoverished children. She had just returned from tours of Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala when we met for our interview.
I have this extraordinary thing that's happened to me, she said. To be able to express my need to help children and to take care of them in some way.
Audrey Hepburn died much too young, at the age of 63, in 1993, at her home in Switzerland. The cause was cancer. But she lives on in her films, forever radiant, and the fantasy of every young woman watching a rerun of Breakfast at Tiffany's, Charade, or Funny Face. So here were these 3 very smart women, also with very different approaches to the balance of family life and career. Where did this leave me? I used to say you could have a great marriage and a great career. Notice I use the word career, not job. Or a great marriage and great children. Or a great career and great children. But you couldn't have all 3 at the same time. I have changed my mind. Today there are many husbands who care deeply about having a strong relationship with their children and will help with their care. They'll even help with the housekeeping. And there are companies like ABC that let women work part-time or do job sharing. On The View, some of our working mothers bring their children in, breastfeed when they need to, and do their jobs well. Do women need more help? Daycare centers at work, more flexible hours? Sure. But things have improved so much that I do think these days you can have marriage, career, and children. But make no mistake about it, it is not easy. I was never able to do it. The ability to take a tragic situation and turn it into optimism and purpose is rare. There's no better example than a man you've probably never heard of. I include him even though he's not a celebrity. Over the years, people have often asked me who, among the countless interviews I've done, is the most memorable. If I'm thinking historically, I say Anwar Sadat. But if I'm thinking on a human level, the answer is Robert Smithdis, whom I first interviewed more than 30 years ago on The Today Show, and again in 1998 for 2020. Robert Smithdis is a teacher and a poet. He is also totally blind and profoundly deaf. I remember his putting his thumb on my lips and his fingers on my vocal cords during our first interview. Lord knows how, but he was able to understand what I was saying. I was absolutely flabbergasted. Smithdis had graduated from college at the top of his class, the first deaf and blind person to do so since Helen Keller. He then earned a master's degree from New York University, the first graduate degree ever anywhere for a deaf and blind student. In the years since I first interviewed him, he had married and was teaching other blind and deaf people at the Helen Keller National Center on Long Island. At his side, also teaching, was his wife Michelle. She, too, was blind and deaf. If ever a person gets beset by frustration or poor-me self-pity, one day, even one hour, with Robert and Michelle Smithdis will cure all. In the course of our profile with the couple for 2020, we first went with them to church. Michelle had just had electrodes implanted in her inner ear and was thrilled to finally have some limited hearing. Bob felt the vibration of the choir simply by touching the pew. Later, I went to their apartment, where Bob made us chicken cacciatore, even slicing the onions. He cooked on a gas stove, gauging the heat of the flame as expertly as any chef. He and Michelle could see nothing and hear little, but how rich their lives were and how independently they lived. They communicated by finger spelling into the palms of each other's hands. Michelle, who also holds a master's degree, Columbia University's Teachers College, could tell if her husband was angry or upset if he fingerspells too fast. An interpreter from the Helen Keller Center fingerspelled my questions to the couple, and they answered me in their own voices. At home, they each wore vibrating pagers to signal that the doorbell was ringing or to find each other in their apartment. They had some help from sighted friends, especially from one truly special woman named Linda Stillman. Mrs. Stillman had spent 5 years with Michelle while she was attending Columbia, fingerspelling the graduate school lectures for her and translating the necessary textbooks into Braille. Can you imagine the task this was for both women? The patience each must have had, the enormous reward for both when Michelle received her master's degree. Michelle and Bob were both avid readers, especially Bob, who read about 20 Braille magazines a month, ranging from The Economist to Popular Mechanics to Martha Stewart Living. And neither one complained about their disabilities. Michelle had had some sight and hearing as a child, but an illness and then an accident robbed her of both. Still, she told me, "I am rather happy with what I am able to do and for what I have, especially for my husband." Throughout our day together, she was smiling and upbeat. Bob, who had lost his sight and hearing at the age of 4, admitted that he missed the ability to see his friends and especially to hear them. "Blindness takes you away from scenes, but deafness takes you away from people," he said. but at this stage in life, I'm very used to being deaf-blind. When I left their house, I was humbled at what an open and optimistic mind can achieve, and brimming with admiration for them, I determined to remember every day how blessed I am. To anticipate your question, I don't remember each day, but I should, and I try. No one has lied to me more or touched me more than the late Richard Pryor. At our first interview in 1979, Richard said, "Are we going to end up liking each other?" I answered truthfully, "I don't know." Richard then said, "Oh, good. I'm glad it's still out there." If Robert and Michelle Smithdus are examples of people who have risen above the difficult circumstances of their lives, the brilliant actor and comedian Richard Pryor is my example of a man who took the enormous talent he was born with and destroyed it. He couldn't help it, and his struggles affected me from the first time we met. I did end up liking him. How could I not? He told me of his horrific childhood. He, a young boy living in a house with his mother, who was a prostitute, listening to the moans and grunts of the lineup of men who came up to her room. He trying to ignore the men rapping on the door to get in. He, a little older, sleeping with a girlfriend he liked, only to be told by his father that he had slept with the girl too. So how could he possibly trust anyone, male or female? At the time of this first interview, Richard was a huge star. He was appearing in the film The Wiz with Diana Ross and Michael Jackson. Almost every young comedian, black or white, wanted to be like him and follow his cutting-edge humor. I, too, was also taken by his brilliance and felt I could ask him anything. He wasn't offended. He welcomed it. Me: "Are you totally off drugs?" Richard: "No. I love drugs. I really do. But I can't do them a lot because it messes up my life, and every time I get in trouble, it's because I end up drinking too much or snorting too much. But I like drugs. I like some cocaine every now and then." Richard had a beautiful white girlfriend named Jennifer Lee living with him, and he spoke of their relationship as being magic time. I stupidly thought he was talking of his love for her. He was actually talking of their doing drugs together. Still, I liked Jennifer, and she seemed to be genuinely devoted to him and to trust him. So did I. That is why, when in 1980, Pryor set himself ablaze and then ran screaming through the streets of his Los Angeles neighborhood with more than half his body burned, I believed everything he told me. He'd been rushed to the hospital, and after a month or so of treatment, he sat down once more with me. He looked god-awful, emaciated and shaking, and although his face had not been burned, he could barely sit because his scarred body was still so painful. "Richard, how did it happen?" I asked as gently as I could. "It was stupid," he replied, laughing. "Me and my partner had been drinking this Jamaican rum, and it spilled, and he went to get a towel out of the bathroom to wipe it up, and I lit a cigarette, and the next thing I knew, I was on fire."
"Were you on drugs?" I asked.
"No," said Richard, almost offended that I had asked. 6 years later, we talked again. There had been enough rumors so that I knew that the last time I had talked to him, Pryor had looked me right in the eyes and lied. "I asked you about the accident, and you carried on and said, 'Oh, it had nothing to do with freebasing. It had nothing to do with drugs.' In short, you lied to me."
"That's true," Pryor said sheepishly. "One reason that I like to lay it on is this. My lawyer at the time had made a statement to the press about how it happened. He didn't really know what had happened, and he was trying to cover my ass. By saying it wasn't freebasing, I was trying to cover his ass. Inside, I'd be screaming. I wanted to tell you the truth."
Me: "It was no accident."
Pryor:
"Yes. To tell the truth, I got crazy one night and went mad and tried to kill myself."
Me: "You really did it deliberately, didn't you?"
Pryor:
"Yes. I was crazy. I'd gone over the top. So I don't really even know how I did it. I remember pouring rum all over my clothes and lighting a cigarette lighter."
Me: "Knowing that you wanted to die, no accident, why did you want to kill yourself?"
Pryor:
I was ashamed.
Me.
Of what?
Pryor.
I was ashamed of myself. I had come to this. God had given me all this. And what did I do with it? I could only end up in a room alone, smoking a bass pipe. All day long, I couldn't stop. I put the pipe down, it jumped back into my hand. I couldn't stop 5 minutes. Do you understand that? 5 minutes. I said to myself, all right, 5 minutes. I won't smoke anymore. It wasn't a minute that would go by. I had to pick that pipe back up. I couldn't tell you. I couldn't tell anyone.
Pryor tried to put the pieces together again, but it was never the same. Jennifer had left him after the fire. Nothing in his life seemed to be working out. Then he got multiple sclerosis. From time to time I called him and we talked about this and that, but we never did another interview. He didn't want to. I didn't want to push. Jennifer, who had always loved him, came back. They finally married, and she took care of him until his death. Jennifer knew how fond I was of Richard, and she called me herself in 2005 to tell me that he'd died. He was 65. Even though he had lied to me, I still think he may have been the most painfully honest man I have ever interviewed. Now I'm going to take a huge leap from a man who destroyed his own life to a man who has tried to uplift the lives of others. I speak of the Dalai Lama, whose words have affected not only me but millions around the world. I met and interviewed the Dalai Lama in 2005 for an unusual 2-hour special we called Heaven, Where Is It and How Do We Get There? By the way, we were originally going to call it Heaven, Does It Exist? But we were told we shouldn't because some evangelical Christians have no doubt that heaven exists and might boycott the program. Not that we were threatened, but why offend if we didn't have to? After all, we wanted the evangelicals to watch the program too. I had briefly met the Dalai Lama some years before in the most improbable place, the boardwalk at Venice Beach, California. I was married to Merv. We decided we weren't getting enough exercise, so off we went at 6:30 a.m. to bicycle. The only person we saw was a man walking his dog, until a car drew up and 6 monks in saffron robes emerged to look at the ocean. One of them was the Dalai Lama. I went up to him, said something inconsequential like, "Good morning, Your Holiness," to which he responded in kind, well, without the "Your Holiness" part. Then the monks got back in their car and Merv and I went off on our bikes, leaving behind the man and his dog. I can only imagine what his wife thought of his mental stability when he went home for breakfast and said, "Guess what, honey, I just saw Barbara Walters and the Dalai Lama on the boardwalk." It was harder getting to the Dalai Lama this time, physically. I flew to New Delhi with my producer, Rob Wallace, and a camera crew, then on to a small airport an hour or so outside Dharamshala, the little mountain sanctuary given to the Dalai Lama for his government in exile in 1960 by Indian Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru. This followed the Dalai Lama's expulsion from Tibet by the occupying Chinese. We timed our visit to coincide with his annual 2 weeks of teachings to his monks and pilgrims. We should have looked at the weather report. The air got colder and colder as we drove up into the mountains, where monkeys looked down at us with surprise from the trees, and we looked up at them with our own surprise. Rain added to the cold when we finally reached the narrow cobblestone streets of Dharamshala. Our hotel had no heat or hot water, and I slept fully dressed under a lot of blankets. Still, the chill went right through you. The Dalai Lama didn't seem chilled at all as he sat outside in the rain, wearing his one-shoulder red robe, chanting for hours to his young monks. There were a few headphones for translations into different languages, but they were hard to come by. Evidently, he occasionally said something funny because his students would laugh and he would giggle. It really was a giggle, not a laugh, and quite infectious. We did our interview after he was through with his teachings. It was still damp and cold, but everything about the Dalai Lama was warm, including his hands. When I extended my hand to shake his, he took it in both his hands and just held it.
His eyes were warm, too, and merry. Our subject was heaven, remember? And Buddhists have a unique concept of what heaven is. 10 directions, the Dalai Lama told me. East, south, west, and north, and above and below. Buddhists don't believe in heaven as a final destination, but as a place to further develop spirituality. For Buddhists, the final goal is not reach there, but become Buddha oneself, he said in his accented, imperfect English. Buddhists believe in reincarnation. The better you have lived your life, the happier your life will be when you're reborn. Conversely, the Dalai Lama said, if someone do very bad thing, kill or steal, he could be born even with an animal body. Gives new meaning to bad dog. The Buddhist religion is far more complex than my brief explanation, but the Dalai Lama, who told me that he considers himself a teacher rather than a god as some feel he is, was deliberately trying to make his belief accessible. In fact, to some degree, reincarnation makes sense to me. I'm certainly not a Buddhist, but part of me believes that someone like my sister Jackie, or others who had very difficult lives, could come back to something better. They may have done something in a former life that reduced them to a not-so-happy existence, but they have paid that price and earned a chance at happiness. On some spiritual level, that reaches me. What touched me most about the Dalai Lama was his definition of the purpose of life. It was, he said, to be happy. How does one accomplish that, I asked. I think warm-heartedness and compassion, he replied. Compassion gives you inner strength, more self-confidence, that can really change your attitude. It was that simple. I compared his definition with those of some of the other great religious leaders I had interviewed for the special. The brilliant Catholic Archbishop I'd talked with, Theodore Cardinal McCarrick, Archbishop of Washington, had said the primary purpose of life for Catholics was to go to heaven. Muslims shared a similar goal, said Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf, the spiritual leader of the Masjid Al-Farah Mosque in New York. We also talked with a noted evangelical leader, Pastor Ted Haggard, of the New Life Church in Colorado Springs. The purpose of life, he told me, was to be born again and to accept Jesus into your life. Otherwise, he said, you, and also I, would probably not get to heaven. Pastor Haggard was smiling and pleasant. Unfortunately, he was later defrocked by his own congregation, due partly to revelations of homosexual offenses. To me, this didn't diminish his beliefs. It only accentuated the hypocrisy of his character. Members of the Jewish faith had a different goal than going to heaven. According to Rabbi Neil Gilman, a professor of philosophy at New York's Jewish Theological Seminary, Jews put more emphasis on living a decent life on earth for its own sake, not for any reward. And here was the Dalai Lama, saying that the purpose of life was simply to be happy, and achieving it was as easy as being warm-hearted and compassionate. I was so affected by that simplicity and by the sweetness of his personality that when the interview ended, I asked the Dalai Lama if I could kiss him on the cheek. He smiled and suggested we kiss as they do in New Zealand, and so we rubbed noses like the Eskimos. He then put a white scarf around my neck and the necks of my camera crew and my producer, giggled, and walked away. But his message lingered. As I told you before, after the visit concluded, as a special treat, I took my small staff on a whirlwind tour of several cities in India, including the dazzling pink city of Jaipur and Agra, where we saw the Taj Mahal at dusk, and again in the early hours of sunrise. Magnificent. For that week, I was the most adorable person. I never got angry, I never raised my voice, and nothing bothered me. I was devoid of jealousy and ambition. I was also slightly boring. But then came the plane trip home and our return to the Western world. Little by little, the old emotions seeped back in. Still, I continue to remember his simple formula for the purpose of life, and I try to practice what he preached. Compassion. Warm-heartedness. Finally, Christopher Reeve. A mountain of a man who took his once strong life, diminished by a tragic accident, and found a new strength that inspired the world. It was not just that I admired Chris's dignity and courage. I got to care about him as a person, for his spirit, his humor, his determination. He had suffered an affliction that would have made most people withdraw from life. Instead, he confronted it and changed the way people looked at quadriplegics. Most everyone is aware of Christopher Reeve's story. The handsome actor, best known for his role as Superman, was paralyzed from the neck down after a freak horse riding accident. The fall occurred on May 27, 1995, during a cross-country competition when Reeve's horse stopped suddenly at a jump. Reeve, an experienced equestrian, pitched forward, caught his hands in the horse's bridle, and was catapulted headfirst onto the ground. The fall crushed his spinal cord. He was barely alive. In a way, I became Christopher's television chronicler. He talked for the first time about his condition on 2020 in September 1995. We did our last of many interviews in November 2003, 11 months before he died. But we regularly saw each other as friends off camera. It turned out that we shared the same birthday, September 25th. I had met Reeve only once, very casually, before his accident. There were journalists he knew far better than he knew me, but he had watched a good deal of television and seen many of my interviews during his hospitalization and the long months later at the Kessler Institute for Rehabilitation in New Jersey. I seemed not to interrupt my subjects, he eventually told me. This was important to him. He could only talk for minutes at a time because a tube in his throat was connected to a respirator that sent air into his lungs and also released air over his vocal cords. He could speak as long as the breath held. Then he had to wait for the respirator to generate another breath before he could speak again. It was a slow process, and the interviewer had to be patient. Because I seemed to listen, Reeve chose me to be the person to whom he would tell his story. We met at the rehab center 4 months after he'd been paralyzed. I had no idea what to expect. I had discussed the interview with David Sloan, my executive producer on 2020. We decided that a proper amount of airtime would be about 15 to 20 minutes. We thought the interview would be too painful for viewers to listen to much longer than that. We were also concerned with what Reeve might look like. Would he be disfigured, difficult to look at? Would he be like someone from an Edgar Allan Poe horror story? Yes, I know that sounds crass, but I had to think in television terms. When we came face to face, however, there he was, sitting straight up in a wheelchair, handsome, with a big smile on his face. His paralyzed arms and hands were strapped to the arms of the chair so they wouldn't flop, and his head rested between two black pads to keep it straight. He wore slacks and a sweater. The collar of his sweater had an ascot tucked in. The ascot covered the air hose, which in turn was attached to his respirator. If the respirator got turned off or the air hose was disconnected, even for a minute, Reeve would die. Sitting next to him, lovely and calm and also wearing a big smile, was Dana, his wife, and the mother of their 3-year-old son, Will. And so began Reeve's recollection of his first days in the hospital. In my dreams, I'd be whole, riding my horse, playing with my family, and we'd have a beautiful boat that Dana and I had worked on together. We'd be making love, Reeve said. Then suddenly, I wake up and it's 2 in the morning, and I'm lying in bed, and I'm on a ventilator, and I can't move. His story was not just about him. It was also a love story. His relationship with Dana had grown and flourished after the accident, in spite of the fact that Chris had very little physical sensation. He could feel her kisses and touches to his face. There was some sensation at a little spot by his left rib and at the sole of his left foot, but nothing more. He felt neither hugs nor, mercifully, pain. When I first was coming out of unconsciousness, Chris told me, I thought, maybe it's not worth everybody's trouble. Maybe I should have them pull the plug.
At that point, Dana touched her husband's face and said to me, I know it went through the minds of every member of the family. How can someone like him live like this? But once he was in the ICU and I could just be near him and next to him and look at him and touch him, I felt, well, I haven't lost him. He's here. Still, she said, the decision whether to live or die was up to him. Do you know when he made the decision not to have someone pull the plug? I asked. When the children walked into the room, Dana answered. They were their little boy Will and Alexandra and Matthew, Chris's teenage daughter and son from an earlier relationship. The minute they all came in, Chris added, I could feel the love and knew that we were still a family, and how lucky we all were that my brain was on straight, and the thought vanished and has never come back again. The challenges were enormous. You have lung problems, skin problems, bowel problems, bladder problems, all caused by the spinal cord, he said. The brain can't get messages through to control these things. He had to have his lungs cleared at least every half hour because he couldn't cough. He couldn't even perspire. It's summer and I can't go outside, he said. I'd overheat and I could black out. Chris was so candid, so compelling, his story so tragic and yet so uplifting, that we aired it on 2020, not for the originally planned 20 minutes, but for a full hour. We repeated the interview twice more, each time to huge ratings. There was something else that Reeve told me, privately, off camera, and it made me grin. While he was lying in the hospital, just becoming conscious, with tubes connected to all parts of his body, a doctor in a white coat came in and with a Russian accent commanded, Turn over. Are you nuts? Reeve thought. I said turn over, the doctor repeated. As Reeve was about to try to answer the imbecile, he realized there was something familiar about the man in the white coat. He wasn't a doctor at all. He was Reeve's old buddy from acting school at Juilliard, Robin Williams. Reeve waited for a breath and almost choked with laughter. He realized, he told me, if I can laugh, I can live. Over the years, I probably did a half dozen reports on Reeve's intense, in some cases unheard of, efforts at rehabilitation. I visited Chris and Dana in their home outside New York City. It had been completely renovated to allow for wheelchair accessibility. We showed Chris's progress and his setbacks. We talked about the bodily functions he could no longer do himself and his terror that the respirator could turn off in the middle of the night. We did reports on Chris's acting. He appeared as a quadriplegic in a remake of the Alfred Hitchcock suspense film Rear Window, and we showed him as a film director, as a motivational speaker, and as a fierce advocate, like Michael J. Fox, for stem cell research. He also founded the Christopher Reeve Foundation, which searches for cures to paralyzing spinal cord injuries and, in the meantime, seeks to improve the quality of life of those afflicted like him. The Reeves and I spent almost every September 25th together, along with our friends Michael Douglas and Catherine Zeta-Jones. It was not just Chris's and my birthday, but, as I've said, Michael's and Catherine's as well. I remember the effort it was one year when we decided to celebrate the occasion in my apartment, bringing all of Chris's special equipment up in the narrow elevator, the oxygen, the respirator, the automated wheelchair with Chris in it. Dana fed Chris birthday cake. We laughed a lot, and Dana sang. By the time of our last interview, Chris had made remarkable progress. Due to years of all kinds of exercises, including special water therapy, and pushing himself to an extraordinary degree, he could finally breathe for half an hour or so without his respirator. This meant that for the first time, he could smell things. I gave him a rose to sniff, and he beamed with pleasure. We drank coffee together, and he could finally enjoy the aroma. Best of all, he was beginning to have feeling in one of his fingers and in his chest. I could now give him a real hug. Maybe, I thought, his dream of recovering will come true. Over the years, Chris had occasionally developed life-threatening infections from which he miraculously recovered.
Then in the fall of 2004, he got another serious infection. This time he didn't make it. He died on October 10th, the day after he'd managed to go to one of Will's hockey games. Chris was 52. Dana and I stayed in touch. She was due to sing on The View in the summer of 2005. She had a lovely voice, and we were all looking forward to her appearance. Then suddenly, for no apparent reason, she canceled. I was perplexed and a little annoyed. Later, I heard the reason. She had never smoked, but she'd gotten lung cancer. Dana died on March 6, 2006, at the young age of 44. All of us who knew her were heartbroken. There are many portions of my interviews with Chris that I could include here, but I've chosen one in particular from our very first conversation. Chris, you also gradually discover that your body is not you, and the mind and the spirit must take over, and you move from obsessing about why me and it's not fair into, well, what is the potential? I've received more than 100,000 letters from all over the world, and it makes you wonder, why do we need disasters to really feel and appreciate each other? I'm overwhelmed by people's support of me, and if I can help people understand this can happen to anybody, that's worth it right there. So I really sense being on a journey. Me, do you think you will walk again? Chris, I think it is very possible I will walk again. Me, and if you don't? Chris, then I won't walk again. Me, as simple as that? Chris, either you do or you don't. It's like a game of cards, and if you think the game is worthwhile, then you just play the hand you're dealt. Sometimes you get a lot of face cards, sometimes you don't. But I think the game is worthwhile. I really do. Whenever I feel even a little bit of despair, I think of Chris, and I tell myself once more how lucky I am and that the game is worthwhile. So here they are, some of the people I've interviewed whose character and philosophy have stayed with me. I think of each of them from time to time and consider myself fortunate to have known them. I may have briefly touched their lives, but they touch mine to this day. Monica. It was the most watched news special in television history. It was also the biggest get of my career. Her name was Monica Lewinsky. She was a White House intern. Every print journalist, television journalist, talk show host, and magazine vied for the first interview with the young woman who almost brought down the President of the United States. When the two-hour interview aired on March 3, 1999, almost 50 million people tuned in. There were reports that the water level in some cities dropped during the commercial breaks, as large numbers of people were flushing at the same time. Unless you are very young, you probably remember a lot about the Monica Lewinsky and Bill Clinton saga. As it unfolded in the late 1990s, the words blowjob became part of our public vocabulary, and when the president, in his testimony before a grand jury, questioned the meaning of the verb is, we all scratched our heads and realized we ourselves didn't actually know. Most of all, we had our opinion of Monica Lewinsky, disgraced, reviled by the press, a promiscuous, silly young woman. When I finally interviewed her, I felt otherwise. But first, here is how I got the get. On January 21, 1998, when the Clinton-Lewinsky story broke, I was in Seattle for an interview with Microsoft founder Bill Gates. As I finalized my questions for the world's wealthiest man, a sex scandal was the last thing on my mind. But it became the first thing on my mind that morning, when the world found out that an independent counsel named Kenneth W. Starr was investigating whether President Clinton encouraged a former White House intern named Monica Lewinsky to lie about their alleged affair. The story had been broken by the Drudge Report on the Internet and the Washington Post. The ABC News desk called me in Seattle to make sure I had a heads up so we could see if an interview with Lewinsky would ever be possible. I was not the only one the news desk called. It was the policy then at ABC for big interviews to be assigned to a correspondent, usually Diane Sawyer or me. Connie Chung, who was at ABC at this time, was also in the mix. This three-way competition was often frustrating and difficult for all of us. In this case, however, the get was so important, and ABC knew that every network was after it, that we were each told to do our best to land the prize interview. Some background. Monica Lewinsky was a 22-year-old intern in the White House when she first met President Clinton in the summer of 1995. When she saw the president, she later told me, "My breath was taken away," and whenever she encountered him after that, they shared intense eye contact. There is a now famous photograph of Monica wearing a beret, gazing adoringly at Clinton when he was out shaking hands with the crowd. Still, the relationship between them might have developed into nothing more had there not been a government shutdown that fall. Due to a budget impasse, most paid staffers were forced to stay home, and young volunteers like Monica took on added responsibilities. On November 15th, the second day of the government shutdown, Monica found herself alone with Bill Clinton in the office of his chief of staff. It was then, she later testified, that she showed the president her thong panties and later that evening performed oral sex on him while he took a phone call. Their sexual liaison continued 2 days later when Monica brought pizza to the president and again they had oral sex. Starting with pizza and panties, this became one of the most famous and scrutinized affairs in history. Monica, by all accounts an energetic and hard worker, obtained a permanent White House job before her internship ended. This allowed her relationship with the president to continue, with sporadic and furtive assignations in the hall, pantry, or bathroom outside the Oval Office. She also received, she later told me, at least 50 late-night telephone calls from the president. By the spring of 1996, some senior White House staffers began to take notice of the time Monica was spending in and around the Oval Office, and in April, arranged to have her transferred to a higher-paying job in the Pentagon. Monica was devastated by her removal from the White House, but the president promised she could return after the November presidential elections. It was at the Pentagon that Monica began to confide in an older colleague named Linda Tripp, who had herself once worked in the White House. Frustrated that the president was not keeping his promise to bring her back to the White House, Monica grew increasingly upset and eventually told Linda Tripp about the ongoing relationship. She loved the president, she told Tripp, and thought he loved her. Monica was not the first young woman to have fantasies about a powerful older man, and Tripp probably knew it. But Tripp, it turned out, had her own agenda. She hated Bill Clinton and was collecting material for a book, so she began secretly tape recording her conversations with Monica on the phone and in person as proof of the illicit romance. Tripp then betrayed her young friend by contacting the Office of the Independent Counsel, which was already investigating various other alleged improprieties involving the Clintons. Would Starr's team like to listen to her taped conversations with Monica? They would. Monica had no idea how much trouble she was in until she kept a date to meet Tripp in January 1998 at the Pentagon City Mall. She thought they were going to discuss her sworn affidavit in a civil lawsuit brought against Clinton by a woman named Paula Jones, stemming from his tenure as governor of Arkansas. Jones, then a state employee, claimed that Clinton had pressured her for sex and she was suing him for sexual harassment. Monica had been subpoenaed and drawn into the case by Jones's lawyers because it would help their case if they could show a pattern of predatory behavior by Clinton. But Monica lied. No, she'd sworn in the affidavit, she had not had a sexual relationship with the president. What she hadn't reckoned on were the contradictory tapes Tripp had supplied to the Independent Counsel's office. And so began the high-stakes game Monica had stumbled into. Tripp was not alone when Monica met her at the mall. She was accompanied by two armed FBI agents, who led her to room 1012 in the adjoining Ritz-Carlton Hotel, where six members of Kenstar's staff were waiting for her. It was, Monica told me later, the most frightening day of her life. For hours on end, they threw questions at her and threatened her with 27 years in prison for perjury, witness tampering, and obstruction of justice. Even worse, she said, the prosecutors also threatened her mother with criminal charges of obstruction of justice because of statements Monica had supposedly made in the trip tapes about her mother's knowledge of the affair. The prosecutors promised Lewinsky immunity, then and there, if she told them everything about her relationship with Clinton and agreed to wear a wire to record conversations with the president's friend, Vernon Jordan. He'd offered to help her find a job in New York, the president's secretary, Betty Curry, and possibly even the president himself. To her credit, which has rarely been acknowledged, Monica refused. When Monica said she wanted to call her lawyer, the prosecutors all but forbade it. After 12 hours of resisting their demands, Monica was able to phone her mother, who came down to Washington from New York City and joined Monica that night. Monica's mother and father were divorced, but she and her mother telephoned her father in Los Angeles. Terrified, her father, a doctor, hired an attorney he knew, and Monica went home with her mother to New York. Monica was so distraught, her mother later told me, that she made her daughter shower with the bathroom door open so that she could be sure that Monica did not harm herself. Most of us still remember just how big this story of an intern's relationship with the president became. Countless news stories dissected every bit of leaked information and misinformation about the nature of this relationship. In a short time, Monica Lewinsky became one of the most recognizable names in the world, with regular reports on the scandal in everything from the Times of London to the Borneo Bulletin. In 1998, her name was mentioned in the U.S. press alone more than 100,000 times. So here was my problem. How to meet this young woman and persuade her to talk to me? The key, as I saw it, was William Ginsburg, the lawyer Monica's father had called in panic and despair. Ginsburg was a successful trial lawyer in Los Angeles whose specialty was medical malpractice. His field of work had led him to become a close friend of Monica's father, a radiation oncologist. With his bow ties and a trial attorney's gift for gab, Ginsburg took immediately to the press and was soon spending much of his time on camera helping to feed the media's insatiable appetite for this story. He spent so much time in TV studios that the only way we were able initially to get him was when my imaginative and aggressive producer, Katie Thompson, saw him speaking live on NBC and persuaded a security guard there to put Ginsburg on the phone as he was exiting the building. While everyone was trying to get to Ginsburg, Katie did. Almost every correspondent has a Booker producer like Katie. They were and still are indispensable in tracking down and helping to line up big interviews. We were then able to arrange one of the more unusual meetings of my career. That Saturday, Katie and I flew to Washington, D.C., to meet Ginsburg confidentially at a private place called the Cosmos Club. When we sat down at the bar, Ginsburg immediately confirmed that there was a relationship between Monica and the president. He explained the legal jeopardy that Monica was in, the independent counsel's office having told Monica that she might serve more than 20 years in prison. He was horrified that Monica, a nice kid, he said, whom he had known since she was a baby, was in this position. Ginsburg then said he would like to speak to me more frankly than he felt comfortable doing in front of my producer. It turned out that he was a bit of a fan and said he enjoyed watching me on 2020. It helped that ABC's much-loved film critic, the late Joel Siegel, was a high school buddy of Ginsburg. Joel and I were friends, and when asked, he had told Ginsburg that he could trust me. In any event, he was prepared to talk to me candidly and totally off the record. No wonder. He said that Monica's relationship with the president had never been consummated, that it wasn't intercourse, and that I should draw my own conclusions. What he was telling me, he said, nobody knew. I pushed further, but that was all he would reveal. But it was more than just sexual.
Clinton also gave her gifts like a hatpin, a marble figurine of a bear, and a special edition of Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. Among her gifts to him was a pottery frog. "What about the rumors of a stained dress?" I asked. He said he didn't know of any such dress. "You cannot disclose anything I've told you," Ginsburg warned me after our meeting. And as I had many other times in my career, I kept quiet. I would, of course, have loved to report what he had confided in me, but I had agreed to speak with him off the record, and I had to keep my word. Though his revelations would have made headlines, I couldn't afford to lose his trust. What I wanted was for him to lead me to Monica. So I kept Ginsburg's confidence, despite all kinds of wild speculation in the press about the Lewinsky-Clinton relationship. Media reports began to appear, some quoting White House officials, questioning Monica's character and credibility. She was, they said, a stalker, a liar, a desperate attention seeker. Hillary Clinton, much later on, said she herself had believed those accusations. Armchair psychologists said her parents' divorce when she was 14 and her problems with her weight made her an emotionally disturbed young woman. White House accusations or not, I believed Ginsburg. Indeed, it would be hard to make up a story like that. When I was later able to share some of what he told me with my colleagues, our senior political correspondent, George Stephanopoulos, one of Bill Clinton's former top aides, didn't find it surprising that the president had talked to Monica at length at odd hours of the night. He said that Clinton had done the same with him, and as a night owl, the president was happy to find people with whom he could hold forth into the wee hours. But George was stunned when I told him about Monica's gift to him of a ceramic frog. He said that very few people knew of the president's thing for frogs, and that made him very inclined to believe Monica did indeed have a close relationship with the president.